This is Rain Hamcast number 48, posted August 21st, 2021, on the rainreport.com and on the YouTube Rain Report channel. See the link on the rainreport.com's main menu. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR. A popular subject on ham radio today is solar cycle 25. When will it peak? How will it compare to the rather lackluster cycle we've just been through, etc.? But we need to put the horse before the cart, i.e., what special or not special factors determine whether 20 meters will stay open tonight or 10 meters tomorrow. One ham who has studied the day-to-day conditions of the HF bands is Carl Lutzelschwab, K9LA, the newly appointed ARRL Central Division Director. His interest in RF propagation goes back to his novice days in 1961. Rains Hapali, KC9RP, recently spoke with Carl about the role the ionosphere plays in HF communication daily. The following is our first of two excerpts from their conversation.
How many layers are there in the ionosphere, and what are the differences?
There are three basic layers or regions of the ionosphere. The lowest is the D region. It's ionized by very short wavelength, high energy radiation from the sun. And basically what it is a detriment, because that's where ionospheric absorption occurs. Absorption is just a reduction in signal strength, and it happens on all bands, although it's inversely proportional to the square of the frequency. So the lower in frequency you go, the more absorption there is, and that explains why 10 meters can have S9 plus signals, whereas 160 meters, a lot of times the signals are at the noise level. It all has to do with absorption in the D region. The next region up is the E region. That was the first one that was discovered way back when, and it was named E region because of the word electric. And that's what they thought. It was an electrical conductor, and I guess you can look at it like that. The E region is pretty much just a daytime region. It pretty much disappears at night, and its major attribute is probably blocks signals from getting up to the F2 region, which offers the longest hops. So the E region is not as bad as the D region, but it can be good and bad. The third region is the F2 region. It's the highest in the atmosphere, and it's responsible for probably 99% of our long-distance QSOs. It's very dynamic. It varies diurnally, you know, over the day, by month, by season, and of course, where we are in a solar cycle. That's a quick picture of the three regions. You notice I call them regions, not layers. A layer kind of leads you to believe that there's something there, but there's nothing in between. But in reality, the ionosphere is a continuous electron density as you go up in altitude. And it just happens that the F2 region and the E2 region are peaks. And there is stuff in between. So I've gotten used to calling them regions, not layers. But layers is okay.
Define F1 and F2.
We can tell the difference by the height in the atmosphere. The E region's around 90 to 120 kilometers up there. F region is above the E region. So height is one way, and also electron density. When solar radiation at various wavelengths impinges on the atmosphere, it creates free electrons. In other words, it knocks an electron off an atom or a molecule, and the electrons are what enable our propagation. We measure the D region with rocket flights and incoherent scatter radar. Ionosondes aren't sensitive enough to measure the D region. We measure the E and F regions with ionosondes. If the frequency is high enough, it will go through the E region, because the E region does not have as many electrons usually as the F region. And we can pin down the number of electrons in the E region and in the F region. And we can actually see an F1 and an F2 region during the day. But during the night, it kind of goes into a combination of just one F region. So we can measure what's going on, and we can see how the electron density varies with height in the various regions and also the actual height of the electron densities.
Is electron density entirely controlled or affected by the sun?
That's a good question, Hap. Certainly, solar radiation instigates the ionization process, you know, knocking a free electron off an atom or a molecule. But there are two other factors that can determine what the ionization or the electron density is at any given time. One is geomagnetic field activity that's tied to what you're probably familiar with, the K index and the A index. The K index is a 3-hour index, so there are 8 of those during the day, and the A index is an average of the 8 3-hour K indices. So the K index is a more short-term parameter, whereas the A index is a daily parameter. It tries to give us a picture of how active the Earth's magnetic field is. The higher the K index, the higher the A index, the more active the Earth's magnetic field, and that can cause the ionosphere to get screwed up. Elevated K indices can modify the electron density. The second parameter we're beginning to realize and find out is that events in the lower atmosphere can couple up to the ionosphere. For example, we can see the signature of a tsunami in the ionosphere. We can see the signature of an earthquake in the ionosphere, and we can see the signature of even underground nuclear explosions in the ionosphere. These may be very small, but we can see them, and they can modify the ionosphere so that things are either better or worse than what the solar radiation alone is doing. It's a very dynamic system up there, and our understanding of the ionosphere is on a statistical basis. We can't predict what's going to happen today. We can predict what the average ionosphere looks like over a month and then tie probabilities to what the days may look like. One of these days, we may have enough understanding that we'll have daily propagation predictions. It's kind of like the weather, a lot of probabilities in there. Let me clear up one thing about the K and A indices. Although they're reported every hour on WWV, remember the K index is a 3-hour index, so it doesn't change over a 3-hour period. It may get reported every hour, but it's the same one for 3 hours. When the next 3-hour period occurs, that's when the K index is updated. And the K index is reported for 00 to 03 UTC, 03 to U6 UTC, et cetera, all through the day.
Why haven't we been able to determine that?
No one ever really took an interest in it, but it's becoming clear with the warming, the atmosphere, and stuff like that. It's leading us into lots of research. And of course, our ability to predict what propagation may not be that important for amateur radio, but for over-the-horizon radars in terms of defense, that's very important.
You're in the middle of HF Propagation 101 with Carl Lutzelschwab, K9LA, an Indiana ham who has taken an interest in HF propagation for over 50 years. We'll conclude this first excerpt of Hap Holly, KC9RP's recent conversation with Carl, after you identify your station. This is Rain Hamcast number 48 for August 21st, 2021. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Rain Hamcast.
The A and K indices you refer to are given every hour and 18 minutes after the hour on WWV on 2.5, 5, 10, 15, 20, and 25 megahertz. Actually, occasionally I'm hearing the 25 megahertz signal.
With respect to 25 megahertz, I think it's been kind of off and on the air. I think what we're seeing right now is we're seeing cycle 25 starting its increase. We've been at solar minimum for a number of years, And that means the higher frequencies won't propagate too well. But as cycle 25 rises, we get more sunspots, we get more solar flux. And what's most important, we get more extreme ultraviolet, because that's what the true ionization source in the F2 region, which is responsible for our long distance QSOs. So what we're seeing now is better propagation on the higher bands. It'll take probably about 4 years for cycle 25 to rise. So it's going to be kind of a slow rise, but we'll see improvement in the higher bands, 15, 12, and 10 meters, as cycle 25 ascends.
Every year, there's what is referred to as a sporadic E season. What makes that sporadic this time of year more than others?
We know that the electrons that make up the sporadic E layer, it's more appropriate to call it a layer because it is a very thin layer of electrons, only a couple kilometers thick. It's not like the other regions of the ionosphere. It's kind of unique in that way. But we know that the source of that is meteor deposition. There are many, many, many meteors that ablate through our atmosphere on a daily basis. And our understanding of how all those electrons are compressed into a very thin layer is not fully understood yet. But we believe wind shear does it. Also, the Earth's magnetic field has a role in it. It does occur every year. I've seen papers that show that the deposition of meteors peaks in the summer, and that sure suggests that that's where the summer peak of sporadic E comes from. Sporadic E doesn't appear to be dependent on a solar cycle very much. So sporadic E season in the summer will occur regardless of where we are in a solar cycle. There's also a minor sporadic E peak in December. So we should also keep a lookout in December, but it's nothing like what happens in May through July and even into August.
Why December?
That one's not real clear to me, and I'm not sure it's real clear to everybody else. There's probably atmospheric issues that are happening that we don't fully understand yet. So I don't have an answer for that.
Is the sun furthest away in December than it is in June, or is it the angle that is more direct one of those months versus the other?
It's the angle. The Earth, its rotational axis is not up and down with the ecliptic, which is the plane in which the Earth goes around the sun. Winter, we are closer to the sun, but the northern hemisphere is kind of tilted away, so that doesn't help. In the summertime, we're farther from the sun, but of course, the northern hemisphere is tilted more towards the sun, and that means there's more solar radiation in the summertime. It's more of a zenith thing as opposed to grazing angles. That's what also determines the seasons, temperatures, and all that stuff. And it has an impact on the ionosphere, too. Let me also say that during the summer months, sporadic E is best in your late morning local time and also your early to late evening local time. This summer sure seemed to be extremely good. I'm sure that has to do with whatever drives the making of a sporadic E layer. But we also got to remember the human factors. Most every radio nowadays has 6 meters, and also the digital modes have just opened up 6 meters and even the higher bands, 15, 12, and 10, regardless of the fact that we're just coming out of solar minimum.
There are references to gray line propagation on the HF ham bands.
Gray line refers to when the path that you're looking at, for example, Indiana to South America, is aligned with the terminator, which is the dividing line between day and night on Earth. We have to remember that the terminator goes around the whole Earth. Like I said, it divides day and night. On the day side, of course, the ionosphere is just starting to form. And on the night side, the D region has pretty much gone away and the absorption is lowest. So there's usually better propagation along the gray line. Like I said, that's when the path is aligned with the terminator. You should always look around your sunrise and your sunset. if it corresponds to sunrise and sunset on the other end of the path you're looking at. It's not something that happens all the time, but if you're in the right place at the right time, it can give you some great enhancements in propagation, especially on the lower bands.
And where does long path fall into all this?
When you look at a globe, there are two ways to get to a distant point. One is a great circle route, which is the shortest distance between any two points on a globe. One is short path, and then the other way around is long path. As the names apply, short path is usually much shorter than the long path. Because it's shorter, that generally says short path is going to be the better of the two. But we have to remember that what decides whether long path or short path occurs is the maximum usable frequency, the MUF, or the amount of ionization in the ionosphere enough to refract your signal back to Earth, and is the absorption low enough for your signal to be detected. That can vary during the day. There are great examples of long path. One of the best ones I have is working Japan in the morning via long path here from Indiana. Hopefully we'll see that as cycle 25 rises and there's more ionization for 28 megahertz, so it can be refracted. That's a path from Indiana to the southeast, and it comes into Japan from the southwest. It occurs quite often. There are a number of known long paths that even happen during solar minimum periods like we're in. It's just another mode of propagation that we can take advantage of as amateur radio operators.
And that's the first of two excerpts from Hap Holly, KC9RP's Zoom conversation with HF propagation expert Carl Lutzelschwab, K9LA, newly appointed ARRL Central Division Director. We'll conclude our visit with Carl next time in RAIN Hamcast number 49, scheduled for posting September 4th, 2021. The RAIN Hamcast is produced by RAIN founder-producer Hap Holly, KC9RP. It is copyright 1985-2021 RAIN. All rights are reserved. RAIN programming is made available under a Creative Commons license. Permission is hereby granted for you to download, share, post, and transmit this biweekly hamcast over amateur radio in its entirety. Your feedback and support for this hamcast are welcome on the RainReport.com. YouTube technical assistance, Tom Shimizu, N9JDI. 73 from the Radio Amateur Information Network, RAIN. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR. Keep on hamming!